Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. Joining me on the show this week are Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington bureau chief of Al Jazeera Satellite TV, and Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics. And here are the issues. The Democratic Party of President Barack Obama had disastrous midterm congressional elections, losing control of the Senate and seeing Republicans increase their majority in the House of Representatives and also sweeping some important governor's races in the states. In the Middle East, around the sensitive site of the Temple Mount in East Jerusalem, deep confrontation between Israelis and Palestinians and worries about a possible new intifada. There have been news reports about a letter sent by President Barack Obama to the Supreme Leader of Iran, proposing cooperation on fighting the Islamic State militants. And in Europe, Germany will be celebrating 25 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall this weekend. Yet Western Europeans seem keen to erect new barriers to Eastern European migration. Those are the issues in the news. Let's start with the political earthquake that has hit where we're sitting, Washington, D.C., this week. There were lots of opinion polls suggesting that the Republicans had a pretty good chance of picking up the Senate and would do pretty well. But they seem to have exceeded that. Abdurrahim, people ask, you know, is this going to be a wave election? Have we seen a wave election?
Well, I suppose the best way that one could describe this election, and indeed every U.S. election, is that it works a little bit like the Lord in mysterious ways. And certainly there's been a lot of mystery. For the Democrats to have lost at a time when the economy was showing really positive signs, but also for them to have lost at a time when they were talking a lot about how the Republican Party is no longer the party of the future. The Democratic Party, they've been saying, is the party of the future in terms of the minorities, for example, that it attracts women. All the various segments of the voting blocs that have traditionally been loyal to them and to President Barack Obama, certainly for the last two runs that he had as president, all that became just complacency. Because the results, as we all know, they took the country in a different direction. And I guess now it's over. So people are already talking about 2016, when Barack Obama is obviously not running. But if you've been able to make this kind of gain in 2014, you probably feel pretty good about your chances in 2016 if you're Republican.
So Stephen Collinson from CNN, Abdurrahim Fukara, he's just put his finger on something which must be very frustrating for Democrats, which is they can point to various things like raising the minimum wage, where it looks like the public is on their side. And they look at the sort of the broad, long-term demographic sort of shift in America towards a less white, more diverse, more Hispanic America. And yet none of that seemed to really work for them this time. What's your explanation for the mood of the American public? Describe the mood of this American electorate going into these votes.
Yeah, what's interesting is that pretty much every election, including midterms, since 2006, has reversed what happened in the previous election. What I think that shows is there's a very frustrated, angry electorate, an electorate that's not feeling the benefit of the economic recovery. Every month we get 200,000 new jobs created, but a lot of people are still not feeling much better than when President Obama came into office in 2009. So you have an electorate which is frustrated, it's angry that things can't get done in Washington, and that is a very bad environment to be an incumbent. What I think we should also remember, though, is that the midterm electorate is a different electorate than the one that shows up in general elections. There are fewer unmarried women, there are fewer Hispanics who vote, there are fewer African Americans. Those people are the core of Barack Obama's political base. So I think it's clear that the president was repudiated in this election, but I think it's also dangerous to draw too many conclusions from this election as to what might happen in 2016.
So, Abdurrahim, I mean, Stephen raises an important point that, again, Democrats will make, which is, you know, the turnout was pretty low. It's about a third of the electorate actually bothered to vote. And it is classically the case in all big Western democracies that when the turnout is low, when not many people bother to go and cast votes, that tends to help conservative right-wing parties because the people who tend to turn out to vote tend to be older, they tend to be a bit richer, and that skews more conservative. So all of those excuses clearly, you know, can be made. But when you look at some of these results, some of these states like Colorado with that sort of huge Hispanic vote, Virginia, which the Democrats really had started to get into the habit of thinking was their kind of state. You know, these are states that used to be solidly conservative, but had started voting reliably Democratic. And they really did think that they could kind of put those on their kind of list of safer, more Democratic states. And they lost Colorado and came within a kind of hair of losing the Senate race in Virginia. So even bearing in mind Stephen's kind of absolutely correct points about, you know, it was a tough election for them, it's a midterm, it's a low turnout, should Democrats be very concerned about how badly they did this time?
They should. They should be extremely concerned. And just to go back to the issue of complacency that I mentioned earlier, I had talked to several Democratic candidates before the election on the issue of turnout. And their position was, talking to the American voters, if you do not show up in force to vote, then you will deserve what you get. Mm-hmm. Some of these candidates had obviously seen the writing on the wall for the Democratic Party. So that the complacency is, again, one part of it. The other part is Barack Obama himself. And it's completely perplexing what's happened with Barack Obama. Because from where I stand, the one thing that has shaped the reaction of the American psyche since 2011 is 2011. Mm-hmm. On this president's watch, Osama bin Laden was killed. And yet, he completely failed to reap the benefits of such a major accomplishment from his point of view. And he became toxic in a lot of places for a lot of Democrats and for a lot of people who may have considered voting for a Democratic candidate, places like Colorado, mm-hmm. but in the end they did not. So it's really a sign of this particular election that whatever he did right, mm-hmm. he just did not reap the dividends of.
So, Stephen, tell us about, I mean, you know, clearly when you looked at the, you know, the television ads that have been just bombarding Americans in swing states, Abdurrahim is completely right that the number one figure in Republican ads was President Obama, in attacking President Obama and him as a weak president in a country that feels all wrong, that's not going right. Now, after elections, people, pundits often talk about, has the victorious party, has the winning side been given a mandate from the voters to do something, a sort of a set of policies? What mandate, if any, have the Republicans gained from this election as they now control both halves of Congress?
It's a good question. And if you listen to the president's press conference the day after the election, it was very striking that he made a clear argument that the Republicans had absolutely no mandate. He several times pointed out that two-thirds of the electorate didn't even show up. His tactic was to show no signs of weakness. He wouldn't sort of attach an adjective to his beating in the election 4 years ago. He called it a shellacking. He wouldn't even go there. The press was out for blood. They wouldn't show them any quarter. So the president is trying to preserve his power in the last 2 years of his presidency by arguing that the Republicans have no mandate. Now, the question is going to be, what do the Republicans do? Do they act as if they were given a mandate by conservative voters, which would mean repeated votes to repeal Obamacare, to attack the president again and again? Or do they try and show in the run-up to 2016 that they can be a governing party instead of a disrupting party? There is some sort of optimism that there may be some cooperation on issues like trade deals with the president, for example. The big Asia-Pacific trade pact that's being negotiated mm-hmm. has probably got a much better chance of passing Congress with a Republican Senate than it did with a Democratic Senate. In fact, Harry Reid, the Democratic leader this year, blocked White House efforts to get trade promotion authority, which allows an up or down vote on a trade deal. So there's some sign that there may be some room for cooperation before mm-hmm. the 2016 election really gets going. But, you know, the president made clear that when it comes to his dearest principles, Obamacare, immigration, there's no room for compromise. And he's operating on the basis that the Republicans don't have a mandate. He still believes he has a mandate from the electorate in 2012.
And Abdur-Rahim, it was fascinating, wasn't it? The night of the election, you saw Republicans coming out and saying two completely different things. You had the man who is going to be the leader of the Republicans in the Senate Majority Leader, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. He came out and said, by his standards, very, very kind of conciliatory things. He said, you know, we're not doomed to have permanent confrontation in this two-party system. I'm determined to work with this president. And essentially, you know, his camp would say the Republicans, now they control the whole of Congress, they have to show that they can govern, that they are a responsible governing party. Otherwise, the American public will punish them. So that's the kind of the optimistic, if you like, the establishment view that we got from Mitch McConnell, who is going to be arguably the second most powerful man in America now. On the other hand, we had members of his own party, senators who may have their own ambitions to run for the White House, perhaps, on the right, saying, no, no, our goal is to confront the president, to hold hearings into his illegal activities, to send him bill after bill after bill until he's sick of using his powers to veto bills. What's your kind of gut instinct as to whether the American public are just going to, having said very clearly they want no more gridlock, they're sick of Washington squabbling, those two forces, the governing wing of the Republicans and the kind of confrontation wing of the Republicans, how do you think the balance of power is going to shape out there?
Well, there's clearly within the Republican Party, as you mentioned, these two trends. Clearly, there's a division of labor. You will take this position and I will take that position. I will take a hardline position on Barack Obama because I have ambitions for 2016. But if I'm Mitch McConnell or like-minded Republicans, then I obviously, having won or having felt, because that night some of them started saying that even before the elections, the results came out, having sensed victory, they obviously started working on the perception that many Americans have that the Republican Party was the party of gridlock. So this accusation is not new. It's something that Republicans and Democrats have been trading, and they trade on every election occasion. It seems to me that as we heard earlier, the Republicans so far, we haven't heard what alternative policies they may have for what Barack Obama does. Repealing Obamacare is not an alternative
policy. There is a list, isn't there? If you're going to be an optimist, there are a list, and Stephen talked about a couple of the issues, you know, work on free trade pacts. There is a list of things that the governing wing of the Republican Party says, you know, they can get done. They think there are areas of agreement. And it's surprising, Stephen Collinson, I think for our listeners overseas, very often these midterm elections, when you don't have a president on the ticket, they're very, very domestic. But one of the things I think that's very striking about these elections is that they've actually been, you know, foreign policy and world events and world headlines fed into these elections, and some of the consequences will be felt overseas too. In this last kind of couple of years of President Barack Obama, if he wants to avoid the fate of being a lame duck, classically in your last 2 years, if you're feeling a bit of a lame duck at home, you look at the world and you start to try and build a legacy overseas. So talk about how the outside world played into these elections and how the outside world may yet feel the effects of these elections.
Right. Well, foreign affairs weren't exactly an issue, but what they did was play into the narrative that Republicans were advancing, that the president is weak, he's out of control. We have crisis after crisis, and the president can't meet them. I'm talking about, for example, Ebola. We had several cases of Ebola in the United States, which came from West Africa, and that fed into the perception that the president was behind events. We had this whole idea of the president being outmaneuvered by Vladimir Putin in Russia. There was also the whole campaign against ISIS. You know, Americans have been told by President Obama that the tide of war is receding in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. He was elected to end wars. Now, suddenly, a month before the midterm elections, he started a new war in the Middle East going after ISIS. Mm-hmm. So that played into the perception that the president was behind world events and he was not leading. Where the world is going to feel the impact of these elections is going to be very interesting. And the president's heading to Asia. He's in Asia right now. And if there's a region that is more conscious of perception and face, mm-hmm. and the idea that the present is diminished, I don't know where it is. So we're going to see a president trying to exert his power overseas, and you have to say that, you know, presidents, as you said, often look to foreign policy in their second term to make a mark, but there's very little low-hanging fruit in a, mm-hmm. in a crisis, you know, stormed world that he can go out and get.
And a complicated world. Well, we'll have more in just a minute, but first a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, of The Economist, and joining me today are Stephen Collinson of CNN Politics and Abdurrahim Fukara of Al Jazeera. This is a reminder you can also listen to Issues online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Abdurrahim Fukara, one of the things clearly that is flashing on the presidential dashboard as a kind of red warning light is the situation in the Middle East. The Middle East is always a source of tension and crisis, but things in East Jerusalem, jointly contested capital of Israel in the views of the Israelis, future capital of a Palestinian state for Palestinians, and we've seen some really extraordinary kind of painful scenes of confrontation and violence the last couple of weeks. What is going on in East Jerusalem?
Well, clearly, despite what's happening between the Israelis and the Palestinians now, Iran, for President Barack Obama, mm-hmm. is still the main issue. But to what extent, let's say there were, it's unlikely, but let's say there were another intifada,
mm-hmm.
another uprising from the Palestinians. Yeah. What will that do to President Obama's handling of the Iranian issue over the next 2 years? He's already been weakened by the sweeping mm-hmm. victory of the Republicans in Congress in terms mm-hmm. of what he can do with the Iranians. But should that blow up between the Israelis and the Palestinians, not only will his attention be diverted from the Iranian issue, mm-hmm. but it will that particular conflict may add further fuel to an already inflamed region, inflamed mm-hmm. in Syria, in Iraq, mm-hmm. in Egypt, in mm-hmm. Libya, and mm-hmm. add to it Israel and Palestine, deadly cocktail.
Just before we turn sort of in detail to this, you know, the ISIS-Iran axis and the painful situation America finds itself in there, let's just focus briefly on. So Stephen Collinson, it's very striking that in America, I don't think people are really following in any great detail what's happening in East Jerusalem. And, you know, we've been here before. You have, as so often in the Holy Lands, you have a piece of ground that is intensely sacred to more than one religion. And that is a very sort of explosive situation. But you have the Temple Mount, revered by Jews as the site of their former Holy of Holies, their temple destroyed by the Romans. But it's also the third most sacred site for Muslims in the world. And you have the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Haram. And you've had this uneasy status quo where once Israel captured the Temple Mount physically from Jordan in 1967, the rule was that Muslims had an exclusive right to pray there, but that Jews could visit if they didn't pray. Now, that's being contested at the moment by religious extremists on the Israeli side. Do you think Washington is alive to how bad and how dangerous this situation could be? And how brightly are the sort of warning lamps flashing, you think?
I think people that follow this in the Middle East are clearly alarmed and they know how bad this could get, but the wider political body of opinion is not particularly following this. You know, I believe that the Temple Mount was the trigger for the second Intifada.
In 2000, when Ariel
right.
Sharon visited.
And this whole argument about the rules shows that the political pressure that Benjamin Netanyahu is under from his own right flank, which was one of the reasons why he was either unwilling or unable to make concessions in the now frozen U.S. brokered peace talks between mm-hmm. Israel and the Palestinians. So people in the administration would argue this is going to continue happening unless you deal with the status of the Palestinians, the status of Jerusalem, and Israel makes peace. So I think that's the way they would come at this.
But in the meantime, though, we clearly have seen signs of the administration putting tremendous pressure on the Israeli government to try and calm the situation down and not allow sort of Jewish prayer on the Temple Mount. I suspect that the focus, Abdurrahim, in Washington, as you say, is mostly on Iran. And this new Republican-controlled Senate has some pretty stern things to say about the president's handling of Iran, and above all, whether he is too weak on the Iran nuclear deal, on the Iran nuclear sanctions, and whether he needs kind of toughening up. Do you think that that's the kind of the next leg of foreign policy we're going to see out of this Republican Senate is deep suspicion and distrust of the president's policies towards Iran?
Well, clearly, I mean, now the Republicans have been waiting for their chance to do damage to the way he's been handling it around for 2 years. Now they have that opportunity to do it in controlling both houses of the Congress. They will make it obviously extremely difficult for him to reach a framework agreement or implement a framework agreement. Many of them have been calling for tightening sanctions on Iran. And clearly, his sanctions policy on Iran has worked. Otherwise, the Iranians would not have necessarily come to the table if they had not felt the economic pinch of the sanctions. But where will the Republicans go from there? It's obvious that, you know, when you look at the region, my sense is that President Barack Obama's calculation is strategic. He looks at the Arab world, and he feels that the Arab world will be living outside history for a while. Who does that leave him with? It leaves him with the Iranians. It's a coherent power internally, despite all its democratic problems. It's powerful in, it's influential in Iraq, it's influential in Syria, it's influential in Lebanon, it's influential in Yemen. And for the Republicans to try and scupper any deal that Barack Obama wants to have with the Iranians, to leave it as his main legacy, perhaps, they would have to have an alternative to Iran playing a role in the Middle East in the foreseeable future. As far as I can see, there is no other power, including Israel, that can play the role that Iran had played in terms of U.S. strategic interests in the past.
Stephen, you cover U.S. politics kind of very closely. I mean, when you get into areas of policy like Iran, and Abdurrahim has set out kind of brilliantly the strains that will immediately emerge if you have the president sort of advancing a sort of big picture realpolitik argument for engagement with Iran, and then the deep sort of instincts to distrust Iran and to distrust this president on the Republican side. But is there absolute unity on the Republican side as well? Or can you see within, you know, some of the new figures who are going to be tremendously important in the new Senate, people who are willing to let the president use his constitutional powers to run foreign policy, and those for whom it's you know, how do you craft the next attack ad on Barack Obama and say he's soft on terrorism? Is there a split even within the Republicans on that kind of front?
There are certainly some Republicans that are prepared to give the president a little bit more running room, but Republicans feel that they've already given the president a lot of leeway. First of all, in this interim deal that was done earlier this year with Iran. And if we get a deal with Iran, it's not going to be a final deal with Iran. It's going to be a framework agreement, and there's going to be continued negotiations. Now, Republicans are very angry about that. They said they gave the president 6 months. They were assured by John Kerry that there would be a deal by the end of November. And there's really not going to be a deal. There's going to be the outlines of the deal, and we're going to continue talking about it into the future. The only reason that the Senate didn't vote earlier this year to increase sanctions on Iran in a way that would have scuppered the interim deal is because Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, stopped it from coming up. He was under intense pressure. When Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, takes control of the Senate in January, he's also going to be under intense pressure, and he's said that he will allow a bill imposing sanctions to come up, and it will very likely pass.
And if you talk to the White House, they would say that if Congress does this clumsily and imposes sanctions over and above those that the president is asking for, then the Iranians will just walk away from the table. This
right, and it's kind of ironic that the biggest threat to a deal, if it's reached, is not coming from the government in Washington or the government in Tehran. It's from hawks in both capitals who oppose a deal. And even if the Republican Senate imposes sanctions to be enforced at a later date if Iran doesn't comply with the deal, that could well be enough to cause the Iranians, as you say, to walk away.
Let's turn finally to Europe and to something which should be a happier story. We don't often have happy headlines at the moment around the world, but 25 years ago, the Berlin Wall fell, and that was an extraordinary advance for kind of human liberty and happiness. And Germany is going to be celebrating that anniversary on November the 9th. We've seen some beautiful installations there, these sort of illuminated white helium balloons that are going to be standing along the line of where the wall stood in Berlin. But Abdurrahim Fakhari, is every part of Europe celebrating unity and the removal of all barriers between the East and the West? Or are we celebrating the fall of the Berlin Wall, but with some ugly populist politics simmering away at the moment?
Yeah, there's obviously there's a lot of trepidation, and there's a lot of mistrust towards Eastern Europeans, either already living in West European countries such as France, for example, mm-hmm. or at the prospect of more of them coming into Western Europe seeking jobs. It's absolutely fascinating. Here in the US, where it was traditionally believed that it's the economy stupid, the economy was showing signs of improvement, and yet that didn't clinch it for the Democrats. Whereas in Europe, there is real apprehension about the economic situation in that country. And part of the ire of Western Europeans in some countries is obviously focusing people from Eastern Europe. It's also focusing people coming in search of jobs from other parts of the world, such as North Africa, for example. That's another issue. But it is ironic that 25 years ago, most Western Europeans were celebrating the fall of the Berlin Wall, and today some of them are wishing that it hadn't actually come down.
That's a brutal, but I'm sure a realistic view of some in Europe. Stephen, are we in kind of recession politics in Europe? Is that what we're seeing with the rise of populist parties and leaders with dire sort of approval ratings?
Yes, I think we are. But I think what we're also seeing is a feeling in some of these countries where right-wing populist anti-immigrant parties triumphed in the European elections is a feeling that the European project has gone too far, too fast, and without the input of people themselves. They believe that, you know, these freedom of movement policies that are adopted by the European Union are something they didn't vote for and something they didn't want. And, you know, it's something that's tearing at the whole cohesion of the European Union. David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, is currently occupied in a tug of war with the German
demanding
Chancellor.
Demanding quotas, potentially right. Demanding quotas, limiting the number
exactly.
of Eastern European migrants who can move to the UK.
Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, said that is a step too far, and you know we know that Cameron is already on record as offering a referendum in the UK on EU membership. So this is a real fault line, and it's got the potential to be very ruinous for the European Union.
Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Abdurrahim Fakhara, Washington bureau chief for Al Jazeera TV, and Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.